Boy, don't you wish these sessions could, you know, go on for the rest of the day? I mean, with somebody like that to talk to. But we have three more for you coming up shortly. We're going to jump from the 40s and 50s to the 60s. And to introduce our next three stars here, and they are stars, I'm going to introduce Stuart Shostak. He is the proprietor, he's a TV historian, which is close to my heart, obviously. He's a proprietor of Shokas Video, shokasvideo.com, which has been selling DVDs now of 50s TV shows, one of the principal places for that. In the last 5 years, he's been the host of Stu's Show on the internet, on shokasvideo.com, in which he interviews a huge range of stars of the 50s and 60s television. And I asked him, because I've known Stu for a while, what about some stars that, also had recording careers? Because obviously there's some overlap here between television and the music industry, particularly in the 60s. And of course, Stu jumped right to that. So to introduce our three stars, Stu Shostak.
It came right out. Hi, everybody. How you doing? What a nice group. Has anybody heard Stu's show on Shokas Internet Radio? Dad! Yeah, I was going to say. I'm really happy to be here. I'm glad that you're all here. We've got three people here that are going to share their stories on how television overlapped with their recording careers, how they enhanced and how they helped each other. And it is an honor to welcome these people to our little gathering here today. Let's start. Are they all back there? Just somebody say yeah. Thank you. I said one, not two. Okay. The first gentleman was a recording star before he was involved in the TV business, but nobody knew his name. He had two number one hits in 1969 when a little TV show premiered on Saturday morning called The Archies went on the air. He had a hit called Sugar Sugar because he was the lead singer of The Archies, and he also was a member, he was the only member of the Cufflinks, and did his own background vocals as well as the lead singing, and that song was called Tracy. Two number one hits at the exact same time, and nobody knew who he was. We'll ask him how he felt about that, but since then, you all know who he is because he's gone on to a fantastic singing, songwriting career. He's producing records for Barry Manilow now, and he's going to tell you all about it. Would you welcome, please, the very talented Mr. Ron Dante! Yes! Thank you, sir. Pick a seat, any seat. Here. I'm going to sit there, so maybe you want to sit as far away from me as you possibly can. No. Okay. This next gentleman you all know because for 8 years, eight wonderful years, he starred as Jeff Stone on The Donna Reed Show. He started out as an actor in movies and television. He is a fine actor. And around the fourth season of The Donna Reed Show, he did a little song called My Dad. Anybody remember that? Anybody remember that? That started a recording career that continued well beyond the run of The Donna Reed Show. And since The Donna Reed Show, he's continued his acting, but more importantly, he now heads an organization called A Minor Consideration. He's been doing this for 22 years. He does wonderful work. He makes sure that children that are working in show business are protected and treated fairly, and he does a magnificent job. And that's still a problem today. A lot of producers still take advantage of kids. When they see this man walk on a set, they know they're in trouble. But not today. He's here to talk about his recording career. Please give a nice big welcome to the one and only Mr. Paul Peterson! The beard is brand new. Do you like it?
New.
Janine likes it, yes.
Thank you, Janine.
All right. Last but not least is a true, you look up the word broadcast legend, the words broadcast legend in the dictionary, and this man's picture is there. You cannot find a more true pioneer in this industry. He started as a teenager in his native state of Tennessee on the air as a disc jockey. Shortly after that, he got his own TV show. It was sort of a Dick Clark-type bandstand show before Dick Clark down in Memphis, Tennessee. He was one of the first people to hear Elvis's records on the radio and to play Elvis's records on the radio and to interview Elvis when he first made his first movie, came back to Tennessee, kind of a local boy makes good type deal. 1959, he moved out here became a disc jockey and a television personality out here, hooked up with his old friend Randy Wood at Dot Records, had a big hit called Deck of Cards. You remember that?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you. My aunt and uncle remember that. Okay, and then he went on to host over 20 game shows in his illustrious career. The first show that he hosted is probably kind of close to everybody here. Where's Tim? You know what the first game show he hosted was called? What's the Song? How about that? But you all know him best because he hosted Gambit and Tic-Tac-Toe and about 18 other game shows in his illustrious career. He is a true broadcasting legend. Welcome, please, the legendary Wink Martindale!
I think I've just heard my obituary.
No, that was just like we rehearsed it, and you owe me $5. Okay, we're going to talk about each of the gentlemen's career and how they related to the television industry for the next half hour or so, and then we're going to turn the microphones around and let you guys ask questions. So listen carefully to what we discuss, and if you hear something that you want to augment on or ask about, feel free to do that when we reach the end of our discussion today. Is Frank Bank in the audience? We have a celebrity in the audience from Leave It to Beaver, Lumpy Rutherford, Frank Bank, right over there. Stand up, Frank. Thankfully for all of us, he has no recording career. Okay. Let me start. Let's start with Mr. Ron Dante, because he was a recording artist long before television came into his life. So in 40 seconds or less, or now take your time. We're going to go into the lunch hour today. I'm sorry. These guys have great stories. Tell us, you're a teenager or you were a young kid when you got interested in the guitar, and how you got into the recording industry, and then how you got into television.
Well, I was lucky enough to be born in New York City, be able to go to the Brill Building, which was a very famous music building on 49th Street and Broadway, and I would audition for different music publishers and just walk up and down the stairs, walk into people's offices with my guitar and say, I sing, I write, listen to my songs. You can't do that today. You can't go anywhere. They'll arrest you if you walk in. So I walked into a guy named Don Kirshner's office, and he listened. He had a major publishing company, and he said, I'm going to sign you as a staff demo maker, singer, and that's the way I got my start. It was great because in the office was Neil Sedaka, Tony Orlando, Carole King, Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, all these great writers and singers. So it was like I hit the jackpot. you can't do that today.
You can't. What was your first? Do you remember the first recording you made on a record album?
Well, I did thousands of recordings. I did lots of demos. I can't even remember the first song. I think it was called Hey Baby. Baby was in every song we ever recorded, I thought. That was yours.
You started doing singing in television commercials, too. Was it that early, about that same time, that you started doing backgrounds in commercials?
No, it was a few years later, after I started being staff demo maker for guys like Carole King and girls. I got into jingles, where some of the songwriters could not write hits, but they could write hit commercials. So they went from the Brill Building on Broadway to Madison Avenue, and they started to write for Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, and they would call the same background singers for their jingles. And that's where I became a jingle singer. You probably heard my voice on your radio cars, in your houses. I sang for every product known to man. I sang for, you name it, I sang for it at one point.
Lead singer, do the Dr. Pepper jingle for him, just a little.
Well, also, McDonald's. You deserve a break today, so get up and get away. Yes, and it was funny, while I was doing that commercial, I met a guy who was just starting out. His name was Barry Manilow. Yeah. And you know what happened to him. He didn't go very far. Right?
Yeah. The detergents. You were doing song parodies around the time Alan Sherman was, right? You don't want to talk about the detergents, Ron?
You know, it's funny. You work all your life to get a hit record. You know, as a singer, you come out of the industry. And the first big record I was on was a novelty record called Leader of the Laundromat. It was a ripoff. It was a parody, a Leader of the Pack. I had to go tell my mother, look, Mom, I'm on the charts with Leader of the Laundromat. She said, you studied all these years to sing for a laundromat. But that was my first hit record with my group, The Detergents. We were the first Weird Al. We actually toured with the Shangri-Las. And they would do Leader of the Pack. We would do Leader of the Laundromat. And people would throw laundry at us on stage.
When you did your... When you, When you did your parodies, were there ever any potential lawsuits from the artists that recorded them straight?
Well, the Leader of the Laundromat, we were sued by the songwriter, Jeff Barry, who wrote Leader of the Pack. And, of course, he got all the publishing on the hit. And Leader of the Laundromat unbelievably sold 1 million records. So he made a fortune on this silly parody. But that was the only lawsuit we ever had. Everybody else was happy that we were parodying their records.
Can you talk briefly on how the Archies came about and how you were chosen to be the lead singer for that? That all came through Kirshner, right?
Yes. Don Kirshner called me and he said, I'm doing a TV show based on Archie comics. The characters Betty, Veronica, Jughead. And we need a lead singer to sing for Archie on this Saturday morning cartoon show. And I knew it would be a big hit. I just knew Don Kirshner had developed the Monkees. He had been the top guy with Rock Concert and his TV show. So I figured this is a win-win situation. I went in, I auditioned for the lead voice, and became Archie for 4 years. And it was very strange because nobody knew who I was. But every Saturday morning, your kids or kids, you know, you may have grown up with this song, they heard the songs.
Unbelievable. Jingle Jangle was another big hit for the Archies, wasn't it?
Well, the follow-up to Sugar Sugar was Jingle Jangle, written by the same writers, Jeff Barry and Andy Kim. Yeah. And it sold 1 million, and it still gets played to this day. It's funny, this music has lasted over 40 years.
Because it was good, and it still is good.
It just caught people's ear, and it's amazing that I license Sugar Sugar, and I get calls from Jeopardy, I get calls from the Seinfeld shows, all kinds of things.
That was over 40 years ago, and you're only 33.
I was a mere babe when I recorded this.
Charm, boy. We were talking in the green room before we came out here, and I asked Ron, because he did the backgrounds as well as the lead, if the Archies ever appeared in real life as a group, and you said...
Well, the Archies never appeared. The deal was that I would be anonymous, the singers would be anonymous, and the cartoon would go out and tour, really kind of like when Sugar Sugar went number one, Ed Sullivan introduced the group, and they played the cartoon. But there were a lot of bogus groups out because there was no live group, so there must have been 20 bogus groups out there. A couple of R&B groups, they had to send out the FBI after the R&B groups because they were calling themselves the Archies. It was an amazing time. A lot of people made a lot of money off that group.
The other thing I'd like you to tell everybody is you helped Paul Schaefer, the band leader on Late Show with David Letterman, get his start, correct?
Well, Paul was in the Kirshner office. He was doing a TV show for Don Kirshner, and Paul and I became fast friends, and I started to put him on my sessions. I was producing a lot more than singing, and Paul was a great guy. He was the only guy that Barry Manilow would turn his piano over to in the studio. He said, nobody plays the piano on my sessions but me. But when I brought Paul Schaefer, and he was so friendly and so good at the piano, Manilow said, well, why don't we let Paul play the piano? And that was the beginning of Paul's career. He became the hottest session player in New York City, went on to do Saturday Night Live. And now he's been on Letterman for, what, 30 years?
Yeah. 30 years this year. Let's just talk about Barry Manilow a little bit. You met him, obviously, when you were doing the jingles and the commercials, because that's, as you mentioned, that's what he did. Well, tell us a little bit about your friendship with him and how you go about, you know, producing his CDs today and your relationship with him.
Well, Barry and I met doing a commercial for a Coke derivative product, and he was a wonderful arranger, a wonderful writer. He said to me, would you listen to some of my songs? And he played me this song, Could It Be Magic?, based on a Chopin Preludes, and I said, well, this is really good stuff. We went into the studio, did demos, I got him a record deal, and we ended up spending 10 years making albums. And we did all his hits, from Copacabana to I Write the Songs. Mandy, of course, was our first hit. And he always wanted to be, it's funny, he wanted to be Henry Mancini. He wanted to be one of the great arrangers, and we pushed him in front. And he was very nervous about being the front man. He said, well, you know, I don't think I'm the front man. And we said, no, you sing and you write the songs. And sure enough, it's been a major career. He's still in Las Vegas. And we just finished his 35th, 40th album called 15 Minutes. It'll be out next month. It's all about fame and what fame can do to you. It's really an autobiographical. He's written every one of the songs. So, yeah. You are on it.
Yeah. On the end of it, Larry King and I do a couple of headlines in the news that wrap up the whole album.
That is great. That is great.
I went over to Michael Lloyd's studio and did that.
I was not there that night. Yeah. That was great, though. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I met Manilow, and he loves TV. TV made his career doing rock concerts.
That was my next question.
Midnight Special.
Too.
Yeah.
But everybody knows who you are now, and thank God we do, because this guy is so unbelievably talented, I cannot tell you. Were you the one who talked Barry Manilow out of quitting playing the piano for Bette Midler and going out on his own?
Yes, Barry was working with Bette Midler, and he said, I'm making $200 a week, and I can't leave her. And I said, if you stay with her, you'll make $300 a week for the rest of your life. So he left her, and he took a chance, and a year later he was playing... He was
at
500 a week. And very happy.
There's a way to be successful in this business. Yeah.
There you go. Unbelievable story. And the man is still appearing. Have you got any concerts? You got a CD coming out, though, right? Or is it out?
I have a CD out called Our Favorite Song, 20 of my favorite tunes. I'm doing a show at Cal State Fullerton called Summerfest, August 20th, which will be with the Buckinghams, you name it, Air Supply, Lou Gramm, a Foreigner. It's going to be an all-day festival.
All right,
August
how about 20th, that?
Cal
Ron
State
Dante,
Fullerton.
Ladies and gentlemen. Let me just slide right over here to Mr. Martindale, because he's got a very interesting story, too. Why don't you tell everybody how you loved radio as a kid and how you got into radio and how that got you a deal with Dot Records.
I've hated radio ever since I was... I like to refute everything he says. It catches him off guard.
He's not the only one.
But ever since I was old enough, I guess, to know what a microphone was, I was fascinated with radio. The fact that you could talk into one of these and it would come out of a radio speaker somewhere... just fascinated the heck out of me. And we didn't have a lot when I was growing up in Jackson, Tennessee, a little town of about 25,000 people. My dad was a lumber inspector, and his Christmas present every year from his boss, Mr. Hanafy, was a year's subscription to Life magazine. No money, just a year's subscription to Life magazine. So I grew up reading Life magazine. And when I became fascinated with radio as a 6 or 7 year old, I used to tear out the pages of the commercials, the advertisements in Life magazine, go into our back bedroom, close the door, and pretend I was on the radio, and I would ad-lib around these commercial points on these advertisements. And it helped me to learn how to ad-lib, although I'm not doing a hell of a good job of it today here. but that's really the way I got started. And of course, my Sunday school teacher at the Lambeth Memorial Methodist Church in Jackson was also the manager of the small radio station. I used to bug the heck out of him to give me a job, and finally he did. $25 a week, and all the newsprint I could wag home to practice with. But that's the way I got started in radio, and I moved on to the other two stations in town, and eventually, a couple of years later, in 53, went to WHBQ in Memphis. And that's a whole story which we can talk about.
Yeah, we can. You came out here. He became a major success in Tennessee. Moved out here in 59, right? Is when you came out here.
Yeah.
And you were working for RKO,
KHJ. Fountain and Vine.
How did you had met Randy Wood in Tennessee,
yeah,
right? How did the Dot Records connection come back to you in 1959-60?
Well, and I have to go back to Memphis. In Memphis, for several years, 7 years I was there, I did the morning show called Clock Watchers, which was always my dream, to do the morning show, because as teenagers, growing up in Jackson, WHBQ in Memphis came in like a local, and we all listened to that radio station, because they played more music than anybody else, certainly in Jackson. And so I became the morning man there, and during that period of time, I was given a television show called Wink Martindale of the Mars Patrol, when the station went on the air with their TV station, Channel 13, a CBS affiliate. And we would drink our Bosco and milk and blast off into space every day with my six little Mars guards and segue into the old Flash Gordon movies for about 3 minutes, and the other 26 minutes was devoted to interviewing kids. So I learned a lot about how to interview kids, which is the reason we do so well together. I segued from that show into another show called the Wink Martindale Top 10 Dance Party, and that was when every city had its Dick Clark, and I happened to be lucky enough to be the Dick Clark of Memphis in the late 50s. And I did this show for Coca-Cola every Saturday afternoon for an hour and a half. Kids would come on, you know, stars would lip-sync their act, just like our local version of American Bandstand. And I used to love to interview people and have guests on the show, and we were always looking for unusual and special guests. And I found out from my minister, Reverend Jimmy Elder, Mullins Methodist Church out on Mendenhall Road in Memphis. He called me one day. He was a big fan of mine, both radio and television, and we went to his church. He said, Randy Wood is coming to town, and he's going to be visiting the local distributorship for Dot Records and doing some promotion work here. would you like to have him on your dance party show? And I jumped at the opportunity because here's the man who had created Dot Records in Gallatin, Tennessee, and given rise to Pat Boone and Billy Vaughn and the Hilltoppers and blah, blah, blah. And so I jumped at the opportunity. Fade to black and come up on Wink's brain, what he has, went to work, and he thought, since I have this local record on called OJ Records, thought it was Moon Love, I will. It was when everybody thought they could sing, and I was one of them, and everybody was making a, you know, an Elvis-type record. So I had this local record, and I thought, I'll lip-sync it the day Randy's in the studio, and maybe he'll like what he hears, and maybe I'll get on Dot. Well, wouldn't you know, I did lip-sync the record. We went out to dinner that night, and over dinner, Randy Wood said to me, how would you like to be on Dot Records? He paid $25,000 to buy my contract from this little outfit in Memphis, and he went on back to L.A. This was 1958. I came out here in March of 59, but late in 58, he would call me and he'd say, don't worry about it. I'm looking for something for you to record. And he said, when I find it, you know, if you aren't already out here, he knew I was coming to L.A. anyway, sooner or later, being transferred by RKO to KHJ from WHBQ television. If it happens before that, I will fly you out here and we'll record. But in the meantime, I'll continue to look for something for you to record. So March of 1959, I fly into L.A. and see these miles and miles of lights. And I turn to my program director who flew in with me, Mark Forrester, and I said, Mark, look at this. What if I don't make it? And I have to go back with my tail between my legs, you know? That happens. He said, something I'll never forget. He said, you be yourself. People in Memphis are just like people in L.A. It's a megalopolis, a melting pot of people. He said, you just be yourself. You'll be fine. And I've never been out of work. I've always done well, and I can't complain. So we landed that night. I stayed at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel for 2 weeks, waiting to go to work at KHJ. And I remember the first Sunday I went to church, first Sunday I was here, Randy Wood stopped by. Beverly Wilshire picked me up and took me to the Methodist Church. He went to Hollywood Methodist Church. So that's how close we were. It wasn't until, we're talking about March of 59, it was in May. One morning I get a phone call from Randy Wood when I got off the air at KHJ. I did the morning show. He said, Wink, I want you to come down to the office. I want to play you something. And I walked up the street on Vine Street up to where Cy DeVore used to be, next door to Wallach's Music City. And Dot Records was above Cy DeVore. And I went upstairs and I walked into Randy Wood's plush office, carpet this thick. I thought, man, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. He put an old 78 record, an old scratchy 78 record on Starday Records on the turntable, his fancy turntable, and it was real scratchy, but it was called Deck of Cards. He said, "What? I want you to listen to this. Let me know what you think of this." So he played it, and about halfway into it, I'm thinking, number one is Stagger Lee and Frankie Avalon, that's what kids are buying, and I'm gonna record a talking record that's semi-religious, and I'm sitting there thinking, what am I gonna say when this is over? Well, he picked the needle up. He said, what do you think? I said, Randy, I love it. I love it. I think it's fabulous. I wasn't about to lose this opportunity to make a Dot record. So sure enough, I worked with Milt Rogers. Got it all down pat, you know, the background singers. We made sort of a city-fied version, if you will, of Deck of Cards. And put it out around, I think it was June of that summer. And nothing happened. I mean, just it was almost like it died and went nowhere. Until one morning I got off the air and Chris Hamilton, who was sales manager at Dot Records, called me. He said, Winky, she still called me, Winky. Winky, we just got an order for Boston, 10,000 of Deck of Cards. And I, you know, the redneck kid I was, I said, is that good? She said, is that good? It turns out that Bob Clayton, a top morning man in Boston, put it on the turntable one morning and played it right out of the blue just to check it out, and the switchboard lit up. And from that day forward, it just swept across the country and ended up selling almost 2 million records. Only got as high as number four on the charts, I believe. It was been a number one in England on three different occasions. But I got to do it on the Ed Sullivan Show that November, and it is a recording that has followed me my entire career. Of all the things, I still have people, I was telling Paul, people say to me, are you the same Wink Martindale who recorded that Deck of Cards? And my answer is always the same. I said, you think there are two people walking this earth with a stupid name like Winky Martindale?
That is a great story. Unbelievable story.
So needless to say, when Randy Wood passed at the age of 94 just a few weeks ago, I felt like I lost part of my family because he was not only did that phase of my life was it so successful and so special to me in my career. But I also had the opportunity to do some A&R work for Randy when I thought I wanted to get out of radio in 1961. Quick story?
Yeah.
Quick story about when I was I was an A&R man at Dot Rare. I was trying to learn the A&R business. And Randy wanted to teach me. And I thought, who could be a better teacher? And I was also made national promotion director for Dot at the same time. So I held, you know, two hats. But when I was in the A&R department, one day somebody walked into the office with a little recording called Tell It to the Birds. And it was by a guy named Dory Alpert. It was a record that was being played on KFWB, Channel 98, Color Radio, KFWB. And it was getting a little, remember those days? 1961, 62, 63. Anyway, it was getting some play on, and selling a few records, causing a little noise, but of course, it obviously was not going to be a big hit. But this person named Dory Alpert said, would you take this on or show it to Randy and perhaps pick it up as a master and put it out on Dot and distribute it nationally, because it was just a little bitty local label. And so I did. I gave him $750 for it. Randy approved it. We put it out on Dot. The record went nowhere. But the person who was Dory Alpert turned out to be Herb Alpert. And Herbie Alpert, I can prove this because I have this picture on the wall at home, an autographed picture by Jerry Moss and Herb Alpert. Wink, if it hadn't been for you and your good ear and your $750, we never would have made it.
Wow.
Signed Herb. And now, whether that's true or not, I mean, that's stretching a point. But they used that Jerry proved to me, they used that $750 plus some money that they had saved up to record The Lonely Bull. And from there, you know. So that's my little...
So the Tijuana Brass is due to Wink Martindale.
And I get a check for $10 every month in my dreams.
That is great. Let me ask you one thing real quick before we talk to Paul. You've been a disc jockey, for, dare I say this, over 60 years? Almost 60 years?
Who's counting?
All right. The music business has changed so much. Where do you, as a disc jockey, where do you see it going? I mean, you've seen the styles come and go. I probably should ask this of all three of you, but from the disc jockey, the player point of view, where are we going?
We were talking about this just before we came in, and I'm so glad that I was raised during the period of time that I was raised. I was glad I grew up in radio in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Because I really don't understand radio today. I understand talk radio, and I listen to a lot of that. But where do you go if you want to hear some decent music on the radio? You have to go, sadly, to satellite. And I say sadly because I love satellite radio. I can listen to the 50s on 50, 60s on 60, 70s on 70. I can even listen to some of the best of the 40s on a 40 channel. But isn't it sad that we don't have terrestrial radio stations, be they AM or FM, that plays this music and that gives people like myself who had the opportunity to learn radio at a local level, can't do that anymore.
You can on my station. You didn't mention my station.
Well, that's true. But
just a plug for myself.
Terrestrial radio stations.
Yes.
And,
yeah. This is the internet.
But, you know, in this day and age, so many look at Clear Channel. How many stations do they own? 10,000 radio stations? And they syndicate them and syndicate them by satellite into local radio stations like Jackson, Tennessee. And that kills the market and kills the opportunity for young guys like Wink Martindale or Paul Peterson or whomever who wants to get into radio the chance to be a local personality and learn their way up as we did. You know, there has to be a starting point. Now people jump into it. And a lot of them don't know what the heck they're doing. But in long way around answering it, but I don't understand radio today really in the overall sense. And I was saying to them, I can't watch the Grammys anymore because I don't understand what the hell they're doing. And as far as country music is concerned, country music is not really country music anymore. Eddie Arnold would turn over in his grave, you know, because it all sounds alike. It all has the drums and the guitars and the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.
Or it's rap.
And I don't, or rap. Well, that's another story. We'll save that for another day. But I don't know. I just, I think it's, I love radio and I love what it's given me, but I hate to see what has happened to it in so many different levels.
Well, I think you have an audience here that appreciates everything that you
y'all
just
know what
said.
I'm talking about, I hope.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, now, if you want to talk about how television influenced the career of an individual, we've got the person right here, okay? Paul Peterson, as you know, was one of the stars of the Donna Reed Show, had a good career before that. He was a Mouseketeer. I don't think we want to go into that today. But he's been in a lot of movies, and it was because of television that he became a recording star. So let's talk about how My Dad came about. Let's start there.
Okay.
If you want to.
No, it's fine. Ricky Nelson was inventing this thing called the bubblegum star, right? He had screaming girls and lots of fans, and I was on a television show, and when they asked me to sing, I said, of course, I want some of that. And Shelley Fabre was also asked. She was very reluctant because she said, I don't have a voice. I'm not a singer. And Donnie Kirshner flew out Stu Phillips, an A&R guy of some repute, and Stu puts a record in front of Shelley called Johnny Angel, put together a beautiful arrangement, huge hit, and me, he handed a song called She Can't Find Her Keys.
They love it. They love it.
You know, as novelty songs go, that's okay. But I couldn't see the screaming babes coming out of this record, you know? And then they made me sing it on the show, which was kind of funny. But it is a funny concept. I mean, any guy in this room knows absolutely our wives, girlfriends never know where their keys are. My keys are, if they're not in my pocket, they are in one place. So it caught on. It was a kind of nice hit to have. But then I got a chance to do some better songs.
Lollipops and Roses.
Lollipops and Roses, which I outsold Jack Jones 3-1.
Yes.
And frankly, I got to tell you, Stu Phillips is a genius as far as I'm concerned. We remain friends. But when Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil brought in My Dad, that was special. Barry had written it for his father who had passed. I couldn't get through the song when I first heard it because it was all past tense. But they changed the words around so I could sing it to Carl Betts on the Donna Reed Show. And it's a beloved episode. It was a great time in my life. The record sells every year. And, you know, they trot us out on Father's Day. And me and Eddie Fisher and Mike and the Mechanics. There you go. You know, it's Oh My Papa and My Dad and In the Living Years. So it was fun. And I have to tell you, the fun I had recording, I was a singer and a dancer. I sang at the Hollywood Bowl, in fact, just up the hill from the Methodist Church, for Easter sunrise services. And I loved to sing. But I was never deluded thinking I was the best singer on the planet. And going out on the road with the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, it was like 6 or 8 acts on one bus. And when I say acts, I'm talking the Supremes, the Drifters, Ronnie Dove, Gene Pitney. Tom Jones was closed the show.
Never heard of any of them.
Never. And for me, because the bus drivers were always quitting, so I got to drive the bus. You know, they could rely on me. To hear the genius of people like that who loved music, to be taught by Gene Pitney to pay attention to each and every person we met in every city. Because every night after the show, he would put his briefcase on his lap and write personal notes to all those people that he had met in the course of that day. He would have their business cards, and he would say to me, if you want a career in the recording industry, you've got to be nice to people. Pay attention. Wonderful for a 17-year-old, you know, to sit there and go, you know, that sounds like my grandfather. This is pretty good advice. And then to see how really brilliantly they performed. You know, I was given a flyer because I was a kid on a television show and the girls would scream and I'd sing 4 or 5 songs and get the hell out of there.
But you love that.
Well, how could you not? I mean, seriously, it wasn't until later when after the success of the records and all the rest and then watching our record label, Colpix, go bankrupt, all they had at the same time was Jimmy Darin, Shelley Fabre, Paul Peterson, the Marcells, and they went bankrupt. And a lot of the guys who distributed my records ended up in federal penitentiaries. Well, I tell this story, you guys appreciate the record business. My first statement, Shelley and I got our statements. on the same day on stage one at Columbia Pictures, and Shelley came over to my dressing room and said, "Paul, did you look at your statement yet?" And I went, "No," and I was excited because I figured it was maybe a Cobra I could buy. Shelley sold 4.5 million records on Johnny Angel and owed Colpix $40,000. And I had sold 2.5 million records with my dad and She Can't Find Her Keys combined, and I owed them $27,000. And what we discovered years later was that we were all being billed for exactly the same recording sessions and the publicity and the high life. But I went to Tony Owen, who was Donna Reed's husband. And Tony was from the south side of Chicago, real name Tony Ornstein. And he talked like this. I'm serious, he talked like this. "Mr. Owen, did you see this statement? Look at this. They're saying I owe them $27,000. "Paul, do you enjoy going out on the weekend, getting paid cash to sing a little bit?" "Yeah, I love it, Mr. Owen." "Good, don't ask." Well, I got it. I understood entirely. Because the business was as controlled as it was, and perhaps corrupt, not perhaps corrupt, and as corrupt as it was. New talent was encouraged. It always had a way to bubble up. You could find the guys and gals in clubs, little clubs, then bigger clubs. You could walk into radio stations. I walked into KRLA and KFWB many times with not just a new record, but to talk to people about the new singers in town. And it was a glorious era, and one thing seemed to count above all others. That is that you showed up on time and you did your work. Didn't matter if you had a headache or you had just broken up with your gal, you put on the best show you could, given the conditions. I always hated going lip sync with the sock hops. Somebody hand me $25. I think you did a few times. But I always thought, if you're gonna sing, sing. And I noticed Ron and I were watching the Lady Gaga Monster Ball, and that's just what she said on stage, too. If you pay $200 to come see somebody sing, they ought to be singing, don't you think? Well, unfortunately, a lot of these manufactured acts today can't sing. They wouldn't know how to do it, how to hit the back of the house. So I enjoyed my time. I really did. It was a wonderful experience.
As I told the audience when I brought you out, your career lasted for several years after Donna Reed ended. What happened? Did you give it up, or did the music industry change on you?
I think it's safe to say the industry changed with the British invasion, that's for sure. But also being the all-American boy in 1966 was not the most popular thing to be. That was Timothy Leary days and 500,000 troops in Vietnam. And I wanted to perpetuate it. I had made some great friends at Motown, Berry Gordy and the Supremes, as I mentioned. And I was, in fact, the first white artist signed at Motown. And I thought, boy, if they're going to give me a chance to really kind of rock, this will be fun. But it didn't fit. There was one other guy there. They had hired a songwriter that I didn't know. His name was Jimmy Webb. And He came in with a song. He was kind of excited I had been signed. And he played this song for me, kind of a travelogue song. And I'm going, by the time I get to Phoenix, what the hell? I want Screaming Girls. And he ended up giving it to my session guitar player, Glenn Campbell. Because I've got to tell you, in all of the years, the idea that Carole King can bring you a song and say, I want you to sing it. It was just a wonderful feeling because I was impressed by her talent. I told you on the air this story about being in Las Vegas with my friends partying, and Lou Adler called and said, Paul, you won't believe this, where are you? I said, well, I'm in Las Vegas. He says, you gotta get here. Brian Wilson wrote a song for you. We're gonna record it today. And I was on the next plane. My God, Brian Wilson. And Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who had some pretty, I think, over 70 number one hits, things like, You Lost That Lovin' Feeling, On Broadway, pretty classy couple. And it was fun to have that level of professionalism asking little old me to come and sing. And after the Motown experience and the change in the record business, I really, I didn't want to pursue it. There is a part of me that likes to be serious and focused on issues larger than myself. I think I retired gracefully, you know? It wasn't until Rhino came around.
But I don't think this audience would mind if you started that career again.
You know, I must tell you, there is a group of us, and I think speaking for the whole panel, we love that music, that era. We love the camaraderie and the brotherhood, and it wasn't manufactured. Half of the people I worked with could walk into a club with three or four pieces and give you a hell of a show. And also, it was professional top to bottom, from the Brill Building that you talked about to distribution, and records were given a chance. I've gone on too long.
No,
it was great fun.
That's, you can blame Mr. Brooks, because we've got to be out of here, and we do want to hear from you.
Yeah.
Follow-up, final question for all three of you.
Sure.
TV influenced all of your careers in one way or another. They're all total diverse. Is TV still as strong today, or is the internet taking over, you know, with downloads as opposed to CD sales? Well, let's start with Ron on this.
Okay.
You got the mic. Go ahead,
Justin
Paul.
Bieber. I mean, the internet's pretty strong.
CD sales, Ron. What do you think? Are they losing out to downloads?
I think everything has changed completely. The game has changed totally. You have to keep up with it. Change is the only thing you can expect. And the internet, YouTube is a very important thing. Twitter, all these places. So they've become the new TV, obviously. And they will break new artists. As Paul said, Justin Bieber is a complete internet star. It's a good time. It's a good time. You're more connected to more people today than you've ever been in your life.
Wink, you touched on it a little bit with the satellite radio. Do you want to elaborate any more on that?
I think it's, you know, if you look at Blockbuster, they just went under, you know, because people don't have to go to Blockbuster anymore. They didn't have to go there because they could go to their supermarket and for one of those little kiosks for a cheaper price, rent films. That same kind of thing is happening now. You know, you don't have to, the CD business will, I think in 5 to 10 years at the most, there won't be a CD in record stores anymore. If we have record stores, quote unquote, even in a Barnes & Noble, will we have a Barnes & Noble anymore, much less a record department? But things are changing so fast, I often wonder, what's it going to be like 10 years from now? If it's what it is today, what's it going to be like in 10 years?
Yeah, we need more people like you and us and Tim Brooks to help preserve this stuff. Anybody have any questions? We have a couple of minutes. Just raise your hand up. Yes, sir, can you meet me over here?
Paul Peterson. Now, was the first hit you had Wonder You that Elvis did later? Or was that The Wonder of You?
No. Give me the mic. She Can't Find Her Keys was the first song that was the hit for me. I think it got to 19 on the charts. My dad did a little better. It got up to 6. I heard you say 4.
Yeah.
The thing that my dad had and has even here in 2011 is durability. Yeah, it stayed around a long, long time. I can remember people calling me after like 3 months, still in Billboard and still like at number 6 and 7 and saying, how can this record last this long? And I said, the simple answer is there are a lot of fathers out there, you know?
Where was The Wonder of You at?
Well, I didn't do that one. It was Lollipops and Roses that I think has confused people, or the Brian Hyland song, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny. No, I kept to my own little niche.
Anybody else? Yes, sir. Oh, that's good exercise.
This is for Ron. I think that when I listen to Archie, the Archie's doing Sugar Sugar, I'm just fascinated by the fact that it has moved so strongly into the field of reggae music. You know, was it originally intended to be a reggae song? Because you hear Bob Marley and a number of the other reggae musicians performing it, and it just, you know, enlivens that entire song beyond, you know, what the Archies did.
I think the feel was definitely Jamaican in many ways, because there's a marimba in it, there's a keyboard, and there's a lot of percussion. The producer of the record, Jeff Barry, loved to do his own rhythm. He was out there playing rhythm and hand clapping and stuff. So I think that kind of a song lent itself to that kind of arrangement. Thank goodness. It was internationally number one. In every country in the world, no matter if they spoke English or not, it was number one. Nobody cared about the lyrics. They really cared about the sound. You know, and Sugar Sugar you can get.
Yeah, it's like, don't worry, be happy.
A question for Wink Martindale. Wink,
yes.
One of my favorite topics, of course, can you tell me what made Randy Wood a great record man?
Well, I think a short answer to your question is he had a fabulous ear. He had grown up owning Randy's record shop in Gallatin, Tennessee, and as you may recall, Gene Nobles and he were partners at that time in Randy's record shop, and Gene was a late night DJ on WLAC, which was a clear channel 50,000 watt station, and they would put packages of records together in the late 40s, and most of those records were rhythm and blues records. In those days it was race music, they called it, or rhythm and blues. And that's how he had an incredible ear for not only the black music, but later on in his career, the white music as well. He had an innate sense that something, it was just like a, I was always lucky as a DJ and some of my other buddies, if you had a fairly good ear and you were able to tell what was gonna, you weren't always 100% right, but if you could tell, if you had a good ear for what was commercial at that time, you had a pretty good sense of what to put on the radio, what to vote on in our record meetings as DJs at KFWB, what records went on the list. If a My Dad came in for by Paul Peterson, for example, I mean, how do you not listen to that and know that's going to be, there's certain records. Sometimes you miss, sometimes you won. But Randy Wood is one of those people, I can't see you, one of those people who just had a fabulous ear and proved it over the years.
Paul, I can't let this one go by. You're in Vegas, you get a call, Brian Wilson writes a song.
Yes.
Go back. Did you record it? And what was it?
I was on the next plane. And when I got to the recording studio, there was Lou and Brian. And Brian was on the piano knocking out a thing called She Rides With Me. And when you hear it, it's a Beach Boy tune. I'm telling you. And I was honored to be there. Because I've always been an admirer of Brian. In fact, the first time I went on stage to sing was at the Burbank Rec Center in 1960, I think it was 1960 or 61, I don't think I was driving. And I was so nervous that a couple of guys you may have heard of, Bill Medley and Bobby Hatfield, walked me out holding my elbows, and the house band at the Burbank Rec Center was the Beach Boys. Well, I did record it, you bet, and it is, and it's on some compilation albums. I think you really enjoyed it. It's a good tune. I was tickled. I did a couple things at Motown that I'm really proud of, too. But you have to be folks like you, collectors of these precious little gems.
All right.
But they're out there. Anyway, I have to run off. Ron and I have to be in San Francisco at 6 for a big union meeting.
Yes.
It's a pleasure to talk with all of you.
Yes. Wink has one quick story, but let's thank Paul Peterson right now, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody stay seated for just a moment.
I just had one more quick story. I don't know why they put this watch in front of me. Nobody else has a watch in front of them.
You're a radio guy, that's
this,
why.
This gets back to, I probably should have told this early on, but I think it's a story that needs to be told. When I was a kid growing up, as I told you earlier, I loved radio, and I loved drama on radio. Every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, I was listening to Melody Ranch with Gene Autry. Every night, Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock, I listened to Mr. District Attorney. I grew up listening to, I'd go to sleep at night listening to Jack, Doc, and Reggie, and I Love a Mystery. I go to, you know, the little, how many of you remember any of those shows I just mentioned?
Yeah.
But Mr. District Attorney was one of my favorites. Lynn Doyle in the title role, Jay Johnston in the title role, Lynn Doyle as Harrington, and Vicki Vola as Miss Miller. And to let you know how deeply involved I was in that show, I knew by heart the introduction, the music, the whole nine yards. And I tell this for a reason that I'll get to on Hollywood Boulevard in just a second. Mr. District Attorney, champion of the people, guardian of our fundamental rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then Jay Johnston would come on and he'd say, and it shall be my, he had this fabulous voice, mellifluous voice, and it shall be my duty as District Attorney not only to prosecute to the limits of the law all persons accused of crimes perpetrated within this county, but to defend with equal vigor the rights and privileges of all its citizens. Now, fade to black and come up on years later. Every morning after I got off the air on KFWB, I'd come downstairs with a bunch of promotion guys, and we'd sit in Aldo's coffee shop and have coffee. A man walked by every day with a walking cane, and we would see him every day. Gil Bogus, who was the promotion guy for Tamla Motown, Barry Gordy, let me know one day that that was Jay Johnston, who had played Mr. District Attorney. And they knew this story of mine and how I was captivated by that show. And they all said, you know, over coffee or breakfast, well, you should go out and say hello to him. I've always been very hesitant to bother people. My wife says I'm too much that way. She says, people think you're, you know, not a very nice person if you don't walk up and say hello and thank you, blah, blah, blah. But I just don't like to bother people. But one day, they talked me into it. And I went outside of Aldo's coffee shop and I said, excuse me, Mr. Johnston. And he turned in that voice that was so familiar, he said, yes. And he was in very slow walking. And I said, Mr. Johnston, I just want you to know how much I enjoyed you over the years. Your show was one of my favorites as growing up as a boy. And I knew every word of it by heart, the introduction, and I did that for him. And you would have thought that I had given him $1 million because he was just floored. Because how many people talked to him about a show that was on in the 1940s on this day in 1960s? He said, could we have a cup of coffee? And so he came back in, and we sat over by ourselves, and he regaled me with stories about not only that, but about radio in general for 2 hours. And I was so glad that I did that. And the reason I bring it up is because, you know, each one of you might want to take away just a little tidbit of something from my story, because within a month, he was dead. And had I not gone out and done this, after I read the obituary, I would have hated myself for not taking the opportunity to make that man's day. And that's my radio story. It's one of my favorite radio stories and a true story, and I just wanted to share it with you.
And I think,
sure.
I think everybody in this room will agree with me that we've had some terrific stories from you guys that they are going to savor for the rest of their lives. Thank you, Wink Martindale. Thank you, Ron Dante. Thank you, Paul Peterson. Thank you all. Have a great time for the rest of the convention.